It is 8:30, and we have with us live in the studios once again, Jav Parrish and Maria Tomchik, co-editors at Eat the State. How are you both this morning?
Good.
Oh, I don't know. Maria fell silent there. I was thinking I might have to give CPR or something, that something might have happened.
It's the caffeine. I had a little dose of caffeine this morning, so I'm ready to talk.
Okay, well, then we should...
And you know, it's so true in radio, and not just this program. I've seen it in many places, that the most interesting conversations happen before the mic goes live. But anyway, we aim for that high standard after we go on the air, too. So I'm doing well.
Very good. Very good. And let's dive in. This week in Iraq, we've kind of been missing this for a couple of weeks doing our regular segment.
So news. One of the things we were discussing is the theme music that we need for this particular segment, because it is a regular feature, and it's going to be for a while, I think.
So, yeah,
because it's not being covered adequately elsewhere, and because there is so much going on, and let's face it, I mean, you know, it's our 51st state, so we should give it the attention and care it deserves.
That's right. So I'm going to just dive in here. It was reported on Thursday that the U.S. has used napalm-like firebombs in Iraq. Colonel Randolph Alice, commander of the Marine Air Group 11, told the San Diego Tribune that the U.S. napalmed two bridges near the town of Numania in south-central Iraq. Now, the direct quote that he said to the San Diego Tribune was, quote, "We napalmed both those approaches." Now, the bomb used was an MK-77 filled with incendiary chemicals. This bomb was used more than once. It was used near Numania, but it was also used just before troops crossed the border into Iraq on villages and towns just across the border. Now, it's filled with incendiary chemicals.
Wait a minute. Just across which border?
The Kuwaiti border.
The Kuwaiti border.
Yeah.
So we were actually using weapons
using
against...
Using it on troop positions.
On troop positions.
Yeah, on
okay.
troop positions, not on the towns. But when you use something like napalm, something very similar to it, this was not actually the same chemical that was used in Vietnam, but it's very, very similar and has the same effect. When you use something like that, it's very, very difficult to avoid civilian casualties. Now, Alice also told the San Diego Tribune, quote, "The generals love napalm. It has a big psychological effect," end quote. Now, of course, it also has a big physical effect, too, as anyone who was deployed in Vietnam and saw napalm being used, or anyone who saw the photos of civilians who were napalmed in Vietnam can tell you, certainly. Now, also, The Guardian reported on Monday that the Pentagon and the Bush administration seemed to not be counting some of the U.S. casualties in Iraq and including them in the official casualty figures. For example, most of the time they exclude deaths from accident, illness, and suicide. The official count of deaths, U.S. deaths in Iraq, is 166 dead. Now, the actual total is more like 248, which is about 100 more. This is as of Monday, about 100 more than died in the first Gulf War. Now, that includes deaths from accident, illness, and suicide. Now, what's even worse is that the Pentagon is undercounting the number of wounded. The official Pentagon statistic is 827 wounded in the war so far as of Monday. Central Command in Qatar says it's about 926. However, unofficial figures are in the thousands, with about half of these people having been wounded since George Bush made his speech on May 1st saying that the war is essentially over. Now, The Guardian quoted...
No, he said the war is over.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Now, The Guardian quoted Lieutenant Colonel Alan Delane, who's in charge... Now, this guy spoke on NPR. He's in charge of airlifting wounded troops into McAndrews Air Force Base. This is a direct quote. He said, over 4,000 have stayed... He's talking about numbers of wounded here. Over 4,000 have stayed at Andrews, and that number doubles when you count the people that were here... That came here to Andrews, and then we send them on to other places like Walter Reed and Bethesda, the 8,000 people he's talking about. 90% of these, in his opinion, were injuries that were directly war-related. So now we're talking about a Pentagon statistic of 827 versus people on the ground saying it's closer to 8,000. And the number of wounded is actually increasing each month. This man said that about 1,200 came through McAndrews in April, 1,500 in May, and the numbers are rising by the month.
And this comes as confirmation of something that's been sort of anecdotally reported off and on, not only throughout Iraq, but also in Afghanistan. You would get persistent reports by journalists out in the field saying that, you know, they witness wounded or dead being airlifted, and then there would be no announcement from the Americans, or it wouldn't show up in the final tallies. But and you've seen these sort of unofficial anecdotal estimates of dead and wounded that have contradicted the Pentagon's. What this was is the first time that various people from within the defense and military establishment within the Pentagon are contradicting each other. Clearly, it's a number that's being heavily politicized.
Yeah, and it shocks me that it's NPR or it's the San Diego Tribune or it's the Guardian that is actually interviewing people at places like McAndrews Air Force Base and asking them, "Gosh, does 827 seem right to you?" And they're saying, "Absolutely not. It's more like a factor of ten higher, you know, than that."
Yeah. So it shocks you because you normally wouldn't get coverage like that from that outlet like NPR.
No, it shocks me because it should be something that you would read in the New York Times and the Washington Post, and you should
see it on NBC
yeah. News.
Yeah, absolutely.
You should be seeing them ask, gosh, you know, we keep seeing all of these stories of people being wounded, but the wounded figure, the official wounded figure, is not going up very much. What's going on here?
And I wanted to talk about another kind of debunking that happened from within the military establishment this week. The Defense Intelligence Agency, sources within the Defense Intelligence Agency, it's not an official report, but there's actually a story in the, I believe it was in the New York Times, so it should get more attention that was out, I believe, yesterday, talking about their analysis of the infamous trailers that were found, the weather balloon trailers that
the mobile bioweapons labs
that in late May, on May 28th, in fact, the Pentagon and the CIA issued a joint statement saying that these were conclusively being used as mobile bioweapons labs. In fact, you had President Bush coming telling reporters the same day, "We have found the weapons of mass destruction." Said with absolute certitude, this was
at the same time that bioweapons experts were saying,
Yeah, and not only bioweapons experts were saying but Iraqi scientists were saying all sorts of people were saying but the White House was insisting that story. Now Bush, within a couple days, he never said that we were mistaken, those weren't the weapons of mass destruction. He just stopped talking about it. But in point of fact, the official White House line has been all along, when he talks about the program, notice they don't say the weapons of mass destruction anymore. They certainly don't repeat the claim that they were making routinely before the war started, that these were weapons that had already been developed, they were on the verge of being deployed, or were already deployed, depending on who you listen to and when, and were an imminent threat to the security of the United States. That was the rationale for starting the war. Well, we've had about three or four different distinct, huge ratcheting downs of that claim now. First, they went from being deployed to being under development and imminent. Then it might be sometime down the road, and then, well, Saddam might be thinking nasty thoughts. And now you have the Defense Intelligence Agency sources coming back and saying, well, we've been reviewing the evidence, and apparently this evidence involves interviewing additional human sources as opposed to the human sources probably in the Iraqi National Congress that told them this whopper in the first place, and have come to the conclusion that almost certainly that it was. And I love the phrase they use. They and these are classified findings, by the way. So we haven't seen the actual findings because as with the Saudi connection that was in the joint congressional investigation in 9/11 that we talked about last week. When it's politically sensitive and damaging to the White House, it suddenly becomes a national security document. They talked about the hydrogen production, and that's what this was, producing hydrogen that could then be used in the weather balloons. That it was unsophisticated, And therefore, because it was unsophisticated, they hadn't figured out that that's what it actually was. Well, when you're in a third world country that has been crippled by the most comprehensive economic and military sanctions in the history of the world, really, over the past dozen years, you know, sanctions that are serious enough to kill over a million people, I would think that most things that require any degree of you know, scientific effort are going to be unsophisticated at that point. But apparently this was too much for the defense establishment to figure out. So anyway, we have yet another example of Bush's own people and the experts within the military establishment contradicting the official line, and B, it's not getting much
attention. Yeah,
none at all.
There were a couple more developments on the Iraqi front this week. Kurdish leaders in Iraq, the head of the PUK and the KDP, sat down with General John Abizaid, the new U.S. commander over there in Iraq, and he asked them to please allow 12,000 Turkish troops to march through Kurdish territory into Iraq to help relieve U.S. troops. And the Kurdish leaders looked at him and they said, not on your life. They denied access for Turkish troops to march through from Turkey through northern Iraq to join the coalition forces. Now, this is a major blow to U.S. efforts to get foreign troops into Iraq, since this is the largest contingent that any one country has promised, are these 12,000 Turkish troops. Now, there are two other options for getting those Turkish troops into Iraq. The first option is to airlift them, which the U.S. would have to pay for and would be prohibitively expensive. Now, the U.S. government is already footing the bill for bringing in Polish troops and troops from about 25, 26 other countries, a few here, a dozen there.
Some of which can be done on commercial flights. I mean, we're talking three from Estonia.
But it's still very, very expensive when you add it all up. We're already footing the bill for those troops. If we had to airlift the Turkish troops, that would bring the costs up considerably. The only other option is to stick them on a boat, which would be very, very, very slow. Now I want to remind you, too, that there are two people from the main Kurdish groups who sit on the Iraqi Governing Council. Now, what has the Iraqi Governing Council been doing in the last couple weeks, and in fact the last month or so since it's been established? Well, by now it was supposed to have done several things. It was supposed to have appointed some government ministers, which it hasn't done yet. It was supposed to have written a few bylaws so that all the people sitting on the council would know how the council is supposed to operate and how the meetings are supposed to be conducted. Hasn't done that yet. It was supposed to have appointed a spokesman so that reporters could have one person to ask questions instead of hunting down individual members of the council. It hasn't done that yet. It was supposed to have defined the council's relationship with various local governments, including city councils and various mayors that have been appointed by the U.S. It met with the Baghdad City Council, but it hasn't defined its relationship to the lower-level governments at all. It was supposed to send representatives to the Arab League meeting this past week. Well, didn't get around to doing that either, and consequently, the Arab League hasn't recognized the Iraqi Governing Council as a governing body in Iraq. In fact, they don't even have regular phone service yet, which is probably true for most of Baghdad. However, you would expect that to be a priority for the Iraqi Governing Council.
And this after the United States has had ostensible control of Baghdad for 4 months. There was still no regular food, phone service, no regular electricity. It's a shambles.
Yeah, it's a shambles. The crime is very, very bad. In fact, the Iraqi Governing Council has done two things this week. It met with Paul Bremer on Wednesday to beg his help in two areas. Please, 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 will you create more jobs for the Iraqi citizenry, which is something the council is supposed to be doing. And please, 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 will you do something about the crime and the security situation in Baghdad? Now, this was the same day that the Jordanian embassy in Baghdad was hit with a car bomb, on exactly the same day that they met with Paul Bremer, asking him for more help with security in Baghdad. This is really a farce. I mean, given what the Iraqi governing council is supposed to be doing, that the only thing they've been able to do is meet with Paul Bremer on their knees and ask for more help, please. The only other thing they've been able to do this week is they decided to move to new offices because their old offices simply aren't secure enough.
So I'm curious, when they meet with Paul Bremer and beg with him like this, and it's obvious that Paul Bremer has the real power here. I think that's a pretty fair statement. I mean, do Vice Roy's usually have this much power that they, like, you know, can issue the edicts and the legislative bodies just have to beg the executive like this? I mean, do we need a new term for this man that's somehow more authoritarian than Viceroy?
I don't know. You know, I have very little experience covering a U.S. Viceroy doing anything, so this is a first for me.
Well, and really, it's a first for about the last 50 years, and really about maybe 100 in terms of taking all the worst elements that didn't work of British colonialism and folding them in with new technology. It gets very, very confusing.
Including promoting tribal government in the occupied country, but anyway.
All right. Well, I understand, connected still on the subject of Iraq, that they're looking at, just got an article sent over to me before we went live, that they're looking at importing 630,000 AK-47s
yes.
into the Iraq.
I saw that.
And why are they doing this?
It's for security reasons.
So they're going to introduce a whole bunch more weapons in order to make it into an already heavily armed country where people know how to use these weapons?
There was probably a major donor to the Bush campaign who had a few on his hands he needed to get rid of. I mean, it is a farce. There are huge stockpiles of AK-47s that the U.S. military has confiscated from Iraqis in the country that they could be using to arm the Iraqi police forces. But for some reason, it's just, you know, makes better business sense for Bush administration allies to have this contract where you import 60,000 more from abroad and just flood the market with more.
Or 600,000.
600,000, no.
Yeah.
Well, and more to the point, you know, if I were a guerrilla force seeking to drive out the Americans, the first thing I would do would be to target getting even more of those weapons. And, I mean, these...
Some of them would be skimmed off, yes.
Yeah, uh-huh. and some of this, and, you know, certainly when you're dealing with an indigenous force where you don't really know who's sympathetic with the opposition, the potential for getting it skimmed off is rather high. But, you know, above and beyond that, this is an opposition force that is already fairly heavily and fairly sophisticated in its weaponry, and we're already seeing that, where there's been a fair amount of preparation and thought that has gone into how can we make life miserable for the Americans. You know, it would be astonishing if the creation of this police force was not used against the Americans at some point.
Mm-hmm. All right, and finally related to that tangentially, you were mentioning friends of the current administration that might have a nice supply of these weapons to give. I saw an article this week about that there was a secret meeting between a couple Pentagon officials and former Iran-Contra arms dealer Manachar Gorbanifar, who was like one of the key players in supplying weapons back in Iran-Contra times. And this is all brought to us via the Undersecretary of Defense for Policy, Douglas Feith, who...
It's also a familiar name.
Yeah, who's in big trouble because he's the guy who's really promoted some of the intelligence. He's the guy who really picked out and promoted some of the intelligence on Iraq's weapons of mass destruction, particularly the nuclear material, and really promoted it to the Bush administration.
Yeah, he was the guy that created the special cell, intelligence cell, that when they didn't have the necessary evidence to back up the claims of weapons of mass destruction, they went over and looked at the info again and magically came up with all this amazing info.
Yeah, and came up with all this iffy info that didn't have much grounding and didn't have multiple sources to back it up, and he promoted it as being credible evidence when we now find out it really wasn't.
And even some of the stuff where there was multiple sources to back it up, it really, and you heard some references to this in the Counterspin program earlier, that you had this sort of sophisticated echo chamber going on where the Iraqi National Congress and some of the exile groups that were in turn funded by the CIA covertly were probably being funded by the Bush administration, were recycling back into the United States, targeting the American public with disinformation that the Bush administration was then using as, you know, an independent source.
Yeah.
All right. Well, let's move along. I have about 10 minutes left. The Pentagon seems to have this magic way of staying away from environmental issues. It's like a Teflon coating they apply before dealing with them.
Well, certainly it's not a hazmat suit because they don't believe in cleanup. But yeah, it actually has been very interesting that one of the few areas in which the Pentagon and Donald Rumsfeld has not gotten its way in the past several months has been around environmental issues. Now, the United States military is already by far, by some enormous exponential factor, the largest single polluter of any agency, any government agency, any private entity, corporation in the world, because they are by and large exempt from many U.S. environmental laws. But we have seen over the past year and a half or so, and particularly in the past 6 months, a pretty concerted campaign by the Pentagon, by Donald Rumsfeld, as part of the appropriations process to try and exempt the Pentagon from some of the same restrictions, the restrictions that it still does face. Now, they still don't have to do most of the kinds of cleanup that a private entity would do, so that, you know, you looked at most, I forget what the number is, it's some ridiculous number of the Superfund sites when that was a seriously maintained list around the country, are either due to the military or on military facilities. But yeah, there was an additional kind of a laundry list of things that Donald Rumsfeld wanted from Congress over the past few months, many of which were folded into something called the Defense Transformation for the 21st Century, which I love the grandiose plans that they give, names that they give to these things. But what Rumsfeld was asking for Congress included things like being able to execute contracts for services for cleanup without bidding, so it could go basically to the buddies of military people, and one lobby group called this the Halliburton Bill of Rights. the protections for whistleblowers were supposed to be removed, so that for places in which the environmental contamination did in fact exist, if somebody brought this to the attention of some outside agency that, say, actually wanted to do something, there would be nothing to prevent that person getting harassed. So-called experts, outside experts that are brought in to study various environmental programs would become political appointees. You know, there were all sorts of little reforms like this that were sort of meant to undermine the ability of outside agencies to monitor what the military does environmentally, and a number of other just sort of little ways in which the Bush administration has been very, very good at undermining the regulations, undermining the procedures, so that even laws that exist on the books are not being enforced, are not even really being paid attention to. Astonishingly, almost every single one of these provisions was either gutted or outright defeated by Congress over the past several months. So and by bipartisan votes, it seems like the environmental provisions of what the military wants is the one thing that Republicans in particular have actually been able to stand up to the Pentagon and be willing to say, no, this is too much, this is too far. That being said, Rumsfeld and the Pentagon are still working and trying to undermine this stuff. So, but for the current appropriation cycle, most of those efforts did in fact fail. It's probably just planting the seeds for trying to get those votes again next year.
Mm-hmm. All right. Well, moving along, right before our war in Iraq really started getting cranked up, we were starting to see coverage in the media to a degree of corporate scandals, at least some of the bigger things.
And they're continuing. We don't hear about
the scandals, not the coverage.
Yes.
The scandals are continuing. Yeah, we're not hearing about them. I just want to talk about one that is in the news, that should be in the news this week. It's kind of this week's corporate scandal. 10 major banks have been caught setting up phony mutual funds to avoid paying federal and state taxes on interest income. Now, here's how their scheme worked. They would set up a mutual fund. Then they would transfer some of their loans. Banks, part of their business is to make loans and collect the interest on them.
And this is private and commercial, both.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. I've got the list of the banks here for you in just a minute. They transfer some of their loans into the mutual fund as investments. Now, the bank itself was the only, in most cases, the bank itself was the only shareholder of the fund. Even though they were required by law to sell shares to the public, they didn't do it. Now, the interest income on those loans, which would have been income in the mutual fund, was then reported to the IRS as tax-exempt dividends. And so the banks were allowed to not pay taxes, or so they claimed. They didn't have to pay taxes on that income. Now, the IRS is looking into these funds and saying, nope, you guys owe back taxes. Now, it's not just the federal government that was ripped off in this way. It was also the state of California, where most of these banks operate. They lost out on some taxes on something like hundreds of millions, if not billions of dollars in profits from 1995 to 2000, which is when the SEC finally clamped down on them and said, let's take a look at these mutual fund funds guys. It's taken them about 3 years to close down the last of these funds. Now, the 10 banks that are involved, I'm not going to read you the whole list. Many of them are not very large banks. But the biggest four are Zions First National Bank, Summit Bank Corp, which has been bought by Fleet Bank, Bank of America, which is the third largest bank in the United States, and our friend and local corporation, Washington Mutual, which is the eighth largest bank in the U.S. and the largest SNL in the United States.
Now, I wonder how many of the current candidates for governor of California sit on the boards of some of those various banks that were involved in that, since most of them are Republican candidates also.
Yeah, it would be interesting to find out. So that's our major corporate scandal of the week.
All right. Well, hopefully that can be a new regular spot as well.
The theme music for that would be an entertaining possibility, too.
That's true.
All right. Finally, we understand that George W. is going to be coming to town here.
Yes, he is. And this is just sort of a heads up for people to get involved in the organizing for that, because there's only 2 weeks he will be in town, on August 22nd and overnight to the morning of the 23rd. That's a Friday and a Saturday. He'll be in Bellevue for a fundraiser on the Friday evening. And then Saturday morning, he'll be probably in Lake City. The exact schedule hasn't been announced yet, and there will be a noon protest at Myrtle Edwards. And he will also be in Portland on the 21st, and the organizing down there is, by all accounts, starting to turn into a mini WTO that's likely to be fairly enormous. So our work is cut out for us. The website that is up says we're going to have 100,000 people turn out in Seattle, which I think is a little optimistic on 2 weeks' notice. But yeah. Nonetheless, clearly a lot of help, a lot of energy is needed to turn out a lot of people. A lot of people in this city that, for many reasons that we've been espousing by and large for a half hour for the last 2.5 years every week, really dislike this guy. And that needs to be made eminently clear, and this is our chance. So for folks who are interested, there is a website that gives the contact info for both the Bellevue and the Seattle protests. It's called StopBushSeattle.com. It's all one word, StopBushSeattle.com. There is a separate website also for the Seattle protest at Myrtle Edwards. That's MVP. That's Martin Victor Paul Seattle.org. MVPSeattle.org. And then the first one again was StopBushSeattle.com. So we've got 2 weeks. 2 weeks from today, and actually 2 weeks from yesterday is when he'll get here. And he'll be down on Weston, at the Weston downtown probably overnight. So folks need to get busy.
What would he be doing in Lake City of Seattle? I mean, what the heck? Is
some carefully contrived photo op, probably. Yeah. But in Bellevue,
that's the strip club.
Yeah, there you go. Exactly. Well, they're going to rezone it again. You see, they're going to have a different vote on it. Okay. No, they're going to give it over to the Social Security. But no, in Bellevue, we'll apparently be having a dinner at the home of the macaws. So
okay.
All right. Well, with that, we're pretty much out of time. Talking once again with Jav Parrish and Maria Tomchik, co-editors at Eat the State. And tell people, where can they find Eat the State?
Eat the State can be found around town in various free places, in bookstores, coffee shops, cafes, in the public libraries, particularly on the east side. The King County Library System carries it most of the time. And you can also find us on the web at www.eatthestate. That's all one word, eatthestate.org. And if you have questions, comments, tips, you want to volunteer, you want to rant and rave about something you heard on this program, you can give us a call to our voicemail message line at 206-903-9461.